Putin and his armies have proved to be weak at classical warfare, giving rise to the meme that Russia has the second best army, not in the world, but in Ukraine. But Putin's expertise in hybrid warfare, disinformation, and active measures continues to achieve success, and it softens responses to Russia around the world, slowing down the supply of lethal armament that would allow Ukraine to win. How far has the practice of history also been warped by Russian narratives and seen through a Moscow-centric lens? To some extent, Russia has managed to convince itself and large parts of the non-Western world that even though it lost the Cold War, it gained some kind of a moral victory, and that it was the victim of Western imperialism and European aggression. We now need to tackle the lies and weaponized mythologies that have supported Russia's diplomatic and soft power initiatives around the world. And now, through its actions, Russia has revealed the ages-old imperialist doctrine and methods that underpin its very existence as an entity. Welcome to Silicon Curtain. All our content is also available on popular podcast platforms like Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Please like and subscribe to help new people find our fantastic speakers. And of course, do please consider becoming a patron to help support the work that we do. Roman Horbic is a senior lecturer at Örebro University. He also worked as postdoctoral researcher at Södertörn University and Umeå University. His published studies are interdisciplinary and focus on various aspects of post-colonial theory, gender studies, sociolinguistics, media power, history of representations and ideas. Roman has also extensively worked as a journalist, publishing articles in Ukraine, Sweden, Denmark, Germany, and Brazil. He is active as a playwright and screenwriter, whose most notable credits include, I might pronounce this wrong, Priputni in 2017. Horbic's current research projects deal with how mobile phones are being used by Ukrainian soldiers and civilians in war. A study based on it received the top paper award at the International Communication Association's annual conference in Paris 2022. Roman, I'm delighted to welcome you to the channel.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. I'm pleased and honored.
Now, today we're going to be talking about colonialism and that academic study of Russian history and how that's going to change, but also going to be tackling this exciting topic of connected civilians and soldiers. So let's start in that place, because the paper I mentioned has done really well. What is the work you're doing around mobile communications and Ukrainian citizens and soldiery?
I don't want to boast, but I think I can say that it is a bit groundbreaking, in fact, because there has been some work done on how mobile phones are used in war, and it is by no means a new phenomenon, because we have seen how mobiles and smartphones and tablets have been used around the world in various conflicts. Saw some interesting cases from Iraq, from Afghanistan, Syria, of course, more recently, and Yemen could be named as well, alongside many other examples. But I think what makes Ukraine different is that it is a very much mediatized battlefield. Which means that Ukraine is essentially a country with a really well-developed communication infrastructure. And it is also, since it is a European country, even though it was before the invasion, also. So people in general, on average, are better off, say, where many of these conflicts in the 2000s and 2010s took place. So it means that people own a lot of tech, and it is quite normal for Ukrainians to own like the last cutting edge models of smartphones, like iPhones, and all sort of manufacturers and trademarks are present. It is quite normal to own like two smartphones, you know, plus maybe an old or several old button mobile. Have tablets, laptops, and the connection. It means that the war is taking place in a really connected, well-connected environment. under the conditions that we in media studies tend to call tend to describe with the concept of connectivity, right? Or we can also talk about connectedness. So it's this condition of permanent connectedness that makes it really different. So think about maybe this traditional image of what modern industrial war is like, right? These images that we have from history books, from history movies, perhaps somehow influenced by the Hollywood productions and blockbusters and so on. So they are mostly shaped by the memory of the Second World War, as well as perhaps Vietnam War, and to a much, much to extent, maybe the wars in the Balkans. But these were wars where connectivity was not there, not in the sense that it is now, and smartphones, right? So soldiers just be... when they enlist, they were completely uprooted from their environment, right? Their ties with their families, their environments were severed, and they were simply, transferred to the front line. They could, of course, write letters to their families. Perhaps at later stages, they could also make phone calls, in the later 20th century. But still, it was a very limited and controlled kind of connection. Now, soldiers are almost like connected 24/7, right? So even when they are in the thick of it, so to say, right? When they are actively taking part in combat, they can be, for example, called, or they can access internet and so on. So this is a very unusual situation, happening at this scale, which makes it really, really unusual. So this is why, and this is what I am focusing on in my project. Yeah, how that changes warfare, how this presence of 24/7 connection, permanent connection to the civilian sphere, to the rear, to the family, but also to each other among the soldiers, how it changes the battlefield, how it changes the very battle. How it changes the war and warfare. So, and I think it does quite a lot to that effect.
And of course, there are a number of things that emerge from that. One is that it humanizes not just the civilians that are suffering, but it also helps us to understand what the soldiers themselves are going through. It gives us that direct connection to not just units, companies, armies, but to actual individuals and their feelings and sensations. In some ways, many of the videos that I'm watching make you think of, All Quiet on the Western Front, or a movie version of a war, in that you start to really feel for the individuals and what they're going through and what they're experiencing, especially, again, given the similarity with the sort of trench warfare, which is a slow, grinding, very intimate form of warfare rather than the rapid movement of, say, the Second World War. Another aspect, of course, which I'll be interested to quiz you on, is the emergence of OSINT, which is open source intelligence, and actually how the use of communication devices by both civilians and military is actually helping with the pinpointing of artillery and the pinpointing of enemy, let's say, stockpiles, logistics, warehouses, and in some cases, tactics and strategies.
Recording device battlefield, because this is also something very new, quite unusual. We saw that already from some little earlier conflicts, such as the Syrian civil war. But at the same time, this is probably the first war where it is happening on this scale. And literally, like I said, every soldier carries a smartphone in their pocket, sometimes two. It's quite customary for soldiers to have a couple of phones, actually, because they are also easily lost and destroyed in the fighting. So people are recording a lot of material, and this is probably one of the best documented wars in terms of the sheer amount of material that exists, Of course, another thing is whether it is the best documented war in terms of what kind of material we get and what kind of material we don't get, because I think still exists a certain gate, you know, that controls access here. But of course, it is a little bit fuzzy, so there are some contradictory tendencies here. I guess we can safely admit that this war continues the trend towards the personalization of war, right? What you mentioned about the like seeing the war through a soldier's eyes, essentially. And that was already present even in the Iraq war, in Afghanistan as well. Embedded journalism did a lot to kind of convey that personal perspective when journalists could be sort of assigned to a certain unit, you know, and spend some time with the soldiers and kind of experience their life and then convey the war through their eyes, right? So it's kind of undermines the idea of journalist impartiality. But on the other hand, it kind of gives this immediacy, like this sense or maybe an illusion of presence. And now it's happening on an industrial scale. So, I mean, it's not even like mainstream embedded journalism any longer. It's citizen journalism by soldiers, essentially. On the other hand, we have a number of genres such as, it's called sometimes in media research, the war porn, right? So a lot of images that are actually quite similar, you know, to these obscure and completely like sick genres such as snuff videos, that purport to show like an actual death. You know, some of them are fake, some of them are probably real, they are traded on web and so on. Now we are seeing how it kind of goes rush side with beheading videos on. So for Russians, for the Russian soldiers, it's both propaganda and an economic model, because these videos are actually traded. They're sold to Telegram channels, who then garner a huge following, of people who are just looking for that kind of content. And so it is a little bit like a porn business in that sense, as horrible as it sounds, and it is horrible. But on the other hand, right, the awesome aspect here is also quite evident, because even in all those videos, the even execution videos, let's just take this example, the perpetrators were identified probably more or less reliably, even the victims of the power of this, right? And it undermines the idea of military operational secrecy, undermines the fog of war in principle, right? Because when everybody's shooting, and not just weapons, but cameras as well, when everybody is filming, the rap. So a lot of artillery strikes were definitely enabled by the videos posted on social media. And of course, Russians respond to that by, prohibiting the use of smartphones for their soldiers, prohibiting the use of social media. But, it's like the sheer scale of it, of the presence of smartphones, makes it completely impossible to control it, to enforce these bans, So it's like, it's a little bit like with the Second World War concept of strategic or terror bombing. A bomber will always get through, so just just because of the sheer number, the items present, right? So if you have a swarm of smart, this is of course a serious challenge for the military, which is partly mitigated again by the amount of material. Then another aspect is how Russians have developed doctrine of mobile blackout warfare. I would call it like this. This is a concept I would like to suggest, because I have noticed a trend in the interviews I'm making, particularly with civilian refugees from the occupied areas, that whenever Russians go in, the first thing that disappears is a mobile and internet connection, because the cell sites are destroyed physically. So that's, I think, I can't say it with complete certainty, but I think a good guess is that Russians are doing it on purpose, because they're also using radio electronic warfare device developed using the experience. This is basically a truck that can launch two drones, which suppress, which jam the mobile signal in the area. And in this way, they try to put this territory they have recently occupied under this mobile blackout. So they isolate it, they break this connectivity, right? Which actually is partly geared towards disabling Ukrainian military communication, because Ukrainians have been using mobile phones and smartphones, and more recently mobile internet powered by Starlink terminals quite a lot in their military communication. Russians attempt to disrupt Ukrainian military communication by destroying mobile communication infrastructure and jamming the signal. But on the other hand, they also managed to keep the atrocities under the wraps. Yeah, so no videos, no photographs, not even like phone calls or text messages can escape this blackout, right? So it's only after the territory is liberated, as it happened in Bucha, that we understand what was really happening there when it was under the occupation, right? So, and this is interestingly, it is something similar to what the so-called Islamic State or ISIS practiced in the Middle East. Because they also had this policy like of no mobiles. They actually burned people like alive for using mobile phones. And so if civilians were found to have a smartphone or use a smartphone, they would be like executed and quite often burned alive on a city square. But they also destroyed the infrastructure, and they also attempted to reach the same result. Yeah, the complete blackout and lack of connection with the outer world. And this parallel in the ISIS tactic and the Russian tactic, I think it raises a lot of questions actually about the nature of the current Russian regime and the Russian military as essentially terrorist organizations, but also raises a lot of questions about potentially even some organizational links between ISIS and Russia, because I think they kind of try to, Russians try to present themselves as liberators from ISIS in Syria. But in fact, I think there are a lot of indicators, such as even, you know, people with the Russian links who, for example, from Central Asian militaries who joined ISIS and became quite prominent figures. The oil deals, the illegal oil deals that were also enabled by Russian assistance quite often. So all of it, like, I think points to the fact that perhaps there was also an actor that was somehow acting in Russia's favor in the Middle East.
And this also shines a light on, of course, Russian colonialism, because we'll dig into academia and its response to that, but it's interesting, isn't it, that Russia's actions now are shining a light on their colonial techniques. And there is still a tendency to say it's Putin's war, it's, you know, the current group of mafia-like sort of thugs who are building private armies and doing this kind of stuff. But actually, this approach to conquer territory, eradicate the identities of the people in the conquered territories, and then use the people from those conquered territories to attack the next territory, which is essentially what they've done with Donbass and Crimea. That is not a new tactic. I mean, that is a classic Russian imperialist tactic That can be seen from the rise, really, of Muscovy in the, you know, 3 or 4 centuries ago. And we're seeing those tactics sort of reemerge in the present day. So let's use that as a sort of gateway to start talking about Russian colonialism and the flawed academic response over the last few decades to interpreting Russian actions in the light of colonial history.
Right. Well, I think we can safely consider Russia an empire, and it's probably the last empire in the world, the last of the great empires of the 19th century that still exists, let's say. I think much of it was obscured by the fact that there was the Russian Revolution in 1917, and then the Soviet Union eventually replaced the Russian Empire. But what Western academia particularly misunderstood about Soviet Union, and that was thanks to silencing perspectives of scholars from within the former Russian Empire, such as Ukrainian scholars or Georgian scholars or even Baltic scholars, for example, Polish scholars, right? Because Poland was also a part of the Russian Empire, a part of Poland was incorporated in it, or Central Asian scholars, right? The Soviet Union was simply an adaptation of the Russian Empire to the new situation, because it was clear in the early 20th century to people like Lenin and also to a lot of Russian liberal politicians, you know, the Constitutional Democrats, for example, and others who were behind the February Revolution, you know, the good, the peaceful revolution, as opposed to the October, you could say, coup by the Bolsheviks. It was becoming increasingly clear to those people that this old style of imperialism is no longer viable. So they were actually actively looking for new concepts and new ideas to replace this old authority or hegemony of St. Petersburg and Moscow earlier in the empire, which rested on tradition, which rested upon religion, and which rested upon pure force, so coercion. And they were coming with a number of concepts, such as an interesting concept suggested by the Russian liberals at that time, the concept of a common Russian, Obshirusky, which sort of recognized, in a way, the existence of Ukrainians and Belarusians as sort of separate ethnicities, right? Because before that, it was basically denied outright, They understood that there must be a sort of compromise, so that it is no longer viable after the revolution of 1905, for example, and after the rise of all these independence movements in the imperial peripheries. It was no longer viable to continue with the old style imperialism. So they suggested, there are these like little Russians and white Russians, and the great Russians, of course, but they're all Russian. They're all common Russians. They're all commonly Russian, right? Which is basically the idea that genealogically predates and directly precedes the idea of the Russian world. That is the key tenet of Russian imperialism today. And the Soviet Union was essentially an attempt to practice that cloak of Marxism and Marxism-Leninism, which is a very kind of brutal, harsh, totalitarian version of Marxism, departing from it in many ways. Under the guise of internationalism and this affirmative action, right? So we can also remind of this concept that was proposed to make sense of the Soviet Union in the 1920s, right? When actually a lot of policies were aimed at promoting local languages and cultures, right? So this affirmative action empire, I think it's a good way to think about it, but we need to be really skeptical, much more skeptical about the scope of the affirmation in this empire, because it was very short-lived, and it was essentially also a way of constructing a hierarchy of ethnicities in which Russians would be the dominant hegemonic ethnicity, the sort of the ruler class, the master nation. While all others were proclaimed equal, in reality, they were portrayed and actually put in a position of being subordinate and subaltern. So I think that was one major omission, you know, the obscurity of to what extent the Soviet Union was an empire, right? And of course, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, well, many of the peripheries that were practically all the peripheries that were already independent in 1917, but then reconquered by the Bolsheviks in the early 20s, they all sort of drifted away from Russia, right? From the Soviet Empire. And it had a potential. It was a sort of a bifurcation moment in Russian history. I think it had the potential to eventually lead to the full dissolution of the Russian Empire, right? Because what remained within the Russian Federation was still based on the imperialist principle. It was still an empire, just a smaller one, without all these Soviet republics that drifted away, but not without the Russian republics within the Soviet Union. But I think war in Chechnya, both as symbolic and a concrete political moment and event that signify that that was not going to happen, and then I think it became very clear that Russia is continuing on this imperialist course. Forget about the even earlier peripheries that were drifting away in under its influence, at least indirectly, because they no longer could control them directly. Well, now they think they can. So they're trying to do that, and they decided to start with Ukraine, because Ukraine is like, it's like the core element. Without Ukraine, the empire is incomplete, and it will ever be incomplete, because the empire was co-created, actually, in a way, together with Ukrainian intellectuals, and it was only probably after the full subordination of Ukraine that Peter the Great actually could proclaim an empire, which he did after, you know, the Battle of Poltava, and when the Ukrainian hopes of independence, or at least autonomy, were utterly crushed. So some 10 years later, 12 years later, Peter the First proclaims the empire. So I think that's the defining moment, even though we can also find a longer tradition behind it.
That's an interesting point to jump into the academic debate, because I know you've been involved in discussions, you've been part of sort of conferences, and a lot of articles are starting to be produced, and that is, how should academia approach Russian studies? Because clearly the 90s, where we gave Russia a sort of free pass after the collapse of the Soviet Union, we projected onto Russia a sort of decolonializing intent, especially with Gorbachev, who was, you know, not the worst, let's say, of Russian rulers in history. We seem to have projected good intentions on Russia, which really weren't there. You know, it wasn't an intentional process of decolonizing. They didn't intentionally liberate Europe. They simply didn't have the strength to hold on to Eastern Europe. They simply didn't have the strength to reconquer countries on the periphery, Georgia, Azerbaijan, Armenia, etc. And they flipped to a mode of economic coercion, active measures, and the more sort of, you know, spy-led, GRU-led kind of approach. But Western academia seemed to, and the press, the media, and so on, seemed to go sort of completely the opposite direction. And that was to project our own sort of liberal aspirations and wishful thinking onto Russia as an entity. And it seems to me that that wasn't there at all. Russia was able, however, to present itself as not a defeated power, but as a victim of Western imperialism and aggression. And that narrative has been remarkably successful in the so-called Global South, India, China, etc., and, of course, across parts of the African continent. Now, obviously, it's more complex than that. There are many countries within Africa, for instance, that have supported Ukraine in the UN votes. So it doesn't work everywhere and amongst everybody. But nonetheless, that Russian mythologizing of its own history and its intentions has proved to be remarkably effective and deformed a lot of the debate and even deformed academic study of the long view of Russian history.
Well, thank you for this really rich comment. And I think there is so much to unpack here. I totally agree that, well, the greatest mistake in back in 1991 was probably giving Russia this sort of advance acceptance after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and probably being too naive and optimistic about that. And in accepting Russia as a sort of civilized, modern, post-imperial, let's say, post-colonial entity in a unilateral and unconditional way, right? There should have been conditions, just like with the post-war, post-Nazi Germany. In the same way, post-Soviet Russia should have fulfilled a number of conditions to be again treated as a member, as a legitimate member of international community, right? But the West chose to close eyes on the crimes of the Soviet Union, which were, I don't want really to compare. Let's just say they were, like, all these crimes are terrible. And in many ways, Russian crimes are as terrible as Nazi crimes. And they had much more time to commit them. So, and much more space, much more people under their control. That was definitely a major mistake here. And in essence, all the resources that the Soviet Union had, they were preserved, all these resources of imperialism. And I'm not simply talking about like resources, like hard resources, right? But even infrastructural resources, symbolic resources, and with this extra bonus of being able to once again portray itself as a victim, because it has been historically, it has been probably the most popular justification for Russian wars of aggression. We are just defending ourselves, right? Like, Russia cannot afford this for, you know, security reasons and so on, right? We are just, we are the innocent part here. We are the victim, actually. And that's what they repeat every time they start a war of aggression. So I think that's quite significant. And I guess that a very symbolic thing. I have recently read an interesting article, actually, in a Belarusian like independent newspaper, Nasha Niva, about how the center of administration in Russia was moved back to the Kremlin in the early 90s after the White House. You know, because the White House, which is like a newer governmental building in Moscow, was a hotspot of like protest activity in 1991 when the Soviet Union was collapsed. It was associated with this pro-democracy activists led by Yeltsin, who challenged, you know, the old Soviet kind of bureaucrats. And for a while, the White House was the center of power, the seat of the president in Russia. But then it was moved back to the Kremlin, and Yeltsin took that decision. He actually wrote about it in his memoirs, very interestingly, that he said, well, it was very hard to leave the White House because I associated it with democracy, sort of, and the fight that we had in 1991. But the Kremlin still had a better infrastructure. It was so centralized, and all the information, flows, you know, all the communications, you know, like all the cables, everything was leading to it. Which, once again, for me as a media scholar, scholar of technology, tells, you know, a lot about how this infrastructural centralism actually tends to reproduce the same pattern of administration, right? So if you once you have this super centralized center, so to say, extreme form of centralism, and I think even infrastructurally, that was completely inherited from the Soviet Union and eventually the Russian Empire. So in that way, Russia was able to actually reinstate itself as an empire in no time, and we can also see that in the Third World or in the Global South. How Russia is basically living off the Soviet legacy, right? Which is, even though, like, I understand why the Soviet Union was seen in the Western colonies as a positive actor, right? As an alternative in a way, and as an example of how these feudal westernized European regimes can be overthrown, right, by sort of agency from below, the way it was like portrayed for the Third World during the Cold War. But that was, of course, a part of Soviet propaganda. And, there is actually so much research and so much knowledge on Soviet propaganda that is still relevant. We just forgot it. We chose to neglected, like I have recently discovered quite fundamental a book from 1964 by Frederick Barkhorn, a US scholar of the Soviet Union, which is called just that, Soviet Foreign Propaganda. And it's great. It's basically a playbook for the Kremlin propaganda today. Right. So in that sense, it's not surprising that Russia is continuing to have some success in the Global South now, the way as the Soviet Union had it in the Third World during the Cold War. There are also like newer factors. I think it is more successful where the local elites are interested in it. And then there are also, of course, people such as Prigozhin, you know, and the Wagner Group, who are very active in Africa. And I think it kind of shows actually the true face of and the true attitude of Russia to the Global South. It actually shows that it's just the same empire. It's actually worse than Western countries today, because they are at least making an effort to face its imperial past and to deal with it. And Russia is just continuing like in the 19th century, you know, by sending troops and sending soldiers to and making deals with local elites in pretty much the same way as, you know, like the British Empire or the French Empire or the Belgian Empire we're doing in Africa. So in that sense, like this Prigozhin activity in Africa, it's like it's basically like very much like it's not different from Western European activity in Africa in the 19th century, which is very ironic, and I think it shows the true attitude of Russia and But it will probably take a lot of time until this will be seen everywhere. And then, yes, speaking about the problem with, let's say, Russian studies, or then we can define this field in different ways, you know, this field of area studies, you know. So some speak about, you know, maybe there are actually overlapping fields. So on the one hand, we have Central and East European studies, which are more like centered on maybe Central Europe, but then can also include like Eastern Europe. And we increasingly see how many parallels from Central Europe can also be found in Ukraine. And in a way, Ukraine is perhaps closer to the Baltic paradigm or the Polish paradigm than it is to this like post-Soviet one. On the other hand, we have this huge field of Eurasian studies, which sort of lumps everything together from, let's say, Warsaw to Vladivostok. And I actually find a lot of issues with it because, ironically, it completely repeats the like the outline of the borders of the Russian Empire in 1913. And I find it deeply ironic that nowhere have the borders of the Russian Empire in 1913 survived so well as in the outline of the field of Eurasian studies. And I think that that kind of legacy, you know, of living in this old empire of knowledge, you know, created in the 19th century, in the early 20th century, when, of course, the Russian scholars dominated the field. They were challenged increasingly in the late 19th century, in the early 20th century, by, for example, Ukrainian scholars. So I would remind, for example, about Mykhailo Hrushevsky, who wrote a completely Ukraine-centric history of Ukraine, the first like continuous and consistent narrative, historical narrative of Ukrainian history, starting with the Kyiv Rus as the like proto-Ukrainian state, actually. We can also think about Ukrainian linguists at the time, who, for example, tried to highlight the similarities that the Ukrainian language has with not just simply with, for example, Polish or Czech language, but actually with the Balkan languages. Like systemically, Ukrainian language shares a lot of features with the Balkan languages, quite surprisingly, right? And kind of opposes it very strongly to the Russian language, right? But these scholars were completely, they were actually bullied by this, by the community of Slavists at that time. They were headed by the Russian scholars, such as Alexei Shakhmatov is a classical example, and he was a liberal, but he wanted to keep the empire. That's the thing, right? He didn't really like the Tsar's autocracy, but he really, really wanted to keep the empire in place. So, and he had a huge authority, even though much of his research, for example, on the old Russian chronicles is now being criticized and questioned, and it's like it's not viable at all, right? So that's all those stereotypes and actually imperial, the imperial optic was inherited by the field of Sovietology, which also, like, it's an interesting field, right? And also an adaptation of the old Slavonic studies or Russian studies to the new realities of this new updated, upgraded empire of the Soviet Union. And it was very contradictory, I think, because on the one hand, it was basically born out of concern in the West, out of security concern, right? So there was this, like, a strong suspicion, you know, of the Soviet Union, and a strong, well, you could say, fear of the Soviet Union, and hence the need and desire to know, right, to understand this logic. But on the other hand, a lot of, much of the field of Sovietology was dominated by again, the Russian emigre scholars who left Russia with little luggage, but they took care to take all of their imperial knowledge luggage with them. And they sort of passed this imperial logic to onto to this field of Sovietology, which was completely also, we have to admit, completely Russia-centric and even Moscow-centric, even Kremlin-centered in many ways. And sadly, that was also inherited by the current, let's say, East European and Eurasian studies. Yeah, this super field, which once again repeats the borders of the Russian Empire in 1913, and which still employs a lot of ideas that should honestly should have been buried a century ago already. So what I'm arguing that we have to actually break up this field of post-Sovietology, as they call it. We have to like actually stop using the concept post-Soviet, I guess. And they're like, as a concept of convenience, sometimes it is it might be necessary, but we cannot really use it to define the field of studies any longer. We are dealing with two different experiences, two different countries, and while we can, what we have to do is actually to refocus the effort on studying the common denominator of having to deal with Russian imperialism, right? This is what post-Sovietology can still do. But otherwise, we need to talk about actually post-Sovietology and perhaps to break up this field. Yeah, it's a heretic idea, I guess. It's a revolutionary idea in some way. And I don't think that many people will like it because it's all about, like, you know, the scholarly, the learned societies, you know, the academies, the professional associations, the conferences we go to, the journals, and so on, right? So it's infrastructurally, like, I think it's many people see it as a dangerous idea for their careers and their position, but we have to very honestly talk about it and very seriously consider the implications of continuing research within this 1913 framework. You know, like, it's time to move on, really, and we have to, like, invest more attention but also more resources into alternative fields, you know, such as, well, Ukrainian studies. Yeah, Ukraine is a huge country, it's a diverse country. Why does Ukraine have to be, like, you know, a footnote to Russian studies? Yeah. Why Ukrainian studies have to be like a room in the palace, in the imperial palace of Russian studies? Well, we need a house of our own, right? Why not Central Asian studies? Yeah. Why not even, yeah, Kazakh studies, for example, right? And then also fields focused on individual countries. Even, well, Russian studies, do we really need it in the same way that it had it has existed all the time? I think it's time to speak about post-Russian studies, yeah, in the way that we have to seriously consider and discuss and, well, the idea and prepare for the a prospect of post-Russia or post-Russian space, you know, once this current Russian Empire hopefully decolonizes and dissolves eventually, you know, with as little violence as possible, hopefully. And in the same way, we have to start talking about post-Russian studies, you know, and we have to amplify the voices of indigenous scholars. We have to pay serious attention to all these indigenous nations of Russia, which it has over 100, you know, and it also depends on how we count and so on. Over 100 minority languages, which are actually original languages, autochthonous, indigenous languages. You know, like, every time I speak at an event at an Australian university or a Canadian university, yeah, so there is always in the beginning this disclaimer, right, about this university being present on the lands belonging to a First Nation, you know, or a certain original ethnicity. There is a recognition, right, of the crimes that were done, and an attempt to sort of remind everyone about this. And that actually does a lot to frame the discussion, to actually provide a frame of reference, right? We need to start talking about Russia in the same way. We need to start treating these indigenous peoples of Russia seriously. So it's, Russia is not about great Russians, you know, as they were known in the Russian empires, right? It's not just about the Slavic Christian Orthodox population that Putin tries to present as the Russian, the Russianness, essentially, right? We need to basically highlight these indigenous nations and amplify their voices and treat Russia as a patchwork and mosaic rather than this, you know, extremely homogeneous and essentialist like image of a white Christian and, you know, traditional conservative country.
I think that's a fascinating place to end. And I think it's a very powerful image, this idea that Russia as an imperial entity predating the First World War survives in the outline of academic studies. I never quite thought of it that way, but it's deeply shocking to realize that. Let's hope that a decolonizing narrative starts to take shape. I know very few people in the Russian opposition even now are talking about it, Khodorkovsky being one of the very few. But let's hope that gains some traction, both in Russia and, of course, in the study of Russia, and a complete reevaluation of its history in the light of its current aggression, which actually does follow historic patterns. Ramon, it's a huge pleasure speaking with you. And I think it's a very essential subject, which I'm so pleased that we were able to touch upon. And good luck in your studies and the work that you're doing. And of course, Slava Ukraini.
Героям слава. Thank you so much, Jonathan. I was extremely pleased and honored to talk with you and be able to develop some of these ideas in conversation. It was really, really interesting. Thank you so much.